Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Stack Waddy game. It occurred to me this week when I found myself reading a story headlined Angry Octopus. I don't know if you saw this.
No.
Some octopus took exception to some zoological chap filming it from a beach.
Right.
And yeah. Pretty much came out of the water and offered him outside. You know what I mean? And so Angry Octopus, I thought, surely there's got to be a band called Angry Octopus. And sure enough, there is a band called Angry Octopus. They're a hard rock group. They come from New Hampshire. And I thought, well, how interesting. How many things use the word angry in their description? Okay, so I've got a load of names here of kind of entertainment phenomena that have got the word angry at the beginning. Have you got to tell me if they're groups or there's something else? Okay.
Oh, right. So some of these are pop groups, right?
Okay.
Idea, incidentally, of an octopus coming out of the water and having 8 shots at once. Yes. You've got a distinct advantage, haven't you?
Absolutely.
Go on.
Okay. Angry salad. What do you think? Pop group or aggressive vegetarian accompaniment?
Okay, I'm saying that's an aggressive vegetarian accompaniment because it's got kind of raw red pepper in it or chili powder or something, is it?
No, you'd be wrong. They're angry salad that continue the city of Boston's tradition of radio-friendly collegiate rock via Rhode Island. Okay, we're moving on. Okay, the Angry Beavers. Angry Beavers. Is that an edgy alternative rock group or is that a children's cartoon? Angry Beavers, what do you say?
Oh, Lord, it sounds like a cartoon, doesn't it? I can see them.
It is. It's an American animated television series created by Mitch Snauer for Nickelodeon. It revolves around Daggett and Norbert Beaver, two young beaver brothers who have moved out of their parents' home to become bachelors in the forest near the fictional way out of town, Oregon. Okay.
Fantastic. It says a lot for the word angry, doesn't it? Because the word angry promises some kind of action, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And some kind of grievance that needs explaining.
Okay.
Carry on. Yeah, go on.
Angry Samoans. Angry Samoans.
Well, if that's a band name, it's a very boring one, isn't it? So, I don't know. But then what would it be if it wasn't a band name?
It's a band name, formed in Van Nuys, California, in the summer of 1978. The band was founded by singers and guitarists Metal Mike Saunders and Greg Turner, a pair of erstwhile rock critics. Wouldn't you just
credit that? Okay. That's fantastic. Metal Mike. Okay.
Angry Penguins. What do you think? Angry Penguins.
Surely we're back in the world of children's television, aren't we? This is an entertainment thing. An angry penguin. Because there's Angry Birds, isn't there? There's the famous
Angry Birds. There you go.
Yeah, so I would have thought that Angry Birds, which incidentally my mother-in-law, aged 93, used to play on her laptop. And we all used to wander in occasionally and tell her to turn the volume down. It was one of those wonderful kind of absolutely fabulous like reversals of role.
I know.
Grant, please turn it down.
Yeah. Angry Penguins. Okay. It's an art and literary journal founded in 1940 by surrealist poet Max Harris. So there you go. I'm going to give you one more. Angry Amputees. Angry Amputees. Rock group or disability rights campaigners?
Must be disability rights campaigners because it would be, I think that would be quite a challenging name for a band, wouldn't it?
Well, it is.
Unless the band comprised of people with disabilities. I mean, maybe that's it.
Which it does. It comes from San Francisco. Angry Amputees, formed in 2001. By vocalist guitarist Stacey D and bassist vocalist John Dalton, a.k.a. Dalty, an actual amputee.
Very good. That's, Dave, that's brilliant.
So there you go.
I'm a bit behind schedule. I haven't managed to get a stack waddy together, I'm afraid.
It's so, all right.
Yeah, I'm having a week off.
We've had a busy week, haven't we? We've been talking to all sorts of people.
Yeah, we have.
And which has caused me to think about all kinds of things. And
Gary Kemp, particularly good, I thought.
Gary Kemp.
I love Gary Kemp. Gary Kemp, he of the Spandau Ballet. What a man. So many theories. So
absolutely.
Much to say, and such a brilliantly clear way of expressing himself. I was really impressed with these fans.
Which actually, we could move on to now, actually, one of the things we talked about, which was a continuation of a conversation we've had on the podcast in recent weeks, about bands. Have they gone away? Or, you know, have they been replaced by a couple of mates, you know, with electronic keyboards and so forth?
Yeah, yeah.
And we put this to him, and he said, well, they probably have gone away because they've gone away with the sense of place, haven't they?
Yeah.
Which is, frankly, that's quite a deep thing for a musician to say, isn't it?
Is.
You don't normally get that kind of
terrifyingly place. Perceptive.
And you thought, oh my God, gonna have to step up to the mark here. That, you know, in the old days, it was all about venues and clubs and gathering your mates, and you had to go somewhere to be with your mates. Whereas nowadays you're with your mates in all kinds of other places, but the other thing I'm thinking further to the question of bands this week is I caught a really interesting podcast with a chat interview with a bloke called Robin Blackburn, who's an evolutionary psychologist.
Okay,
and he's a really interesting guy, and his theory is you only have 150 people in your kind of social circle, in your, you know, family, work, friends. There's 150 people.
I've heard that before. That's meant to be the limit to which you can have any kind of reasonably deep relationship with.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Any kind of meaningful social relationship, in the sense that you would call on them if you had a problem, you know, one way or another. And you would expect that they would reciprocate and you'd do the same for them. But he was really interesting talking about the whole nature of people doing things together, which, of course, at the moment, you know, we've had a year of this is how we do things together.
Yeah,
in a very,
absolutely.
Very different way. And there's all kind of talk about, will people come back together? Will they want to go back to work? Will they want to go to gigs and so forth? And he was he's really interesting in all this. Because he said that the experience of doing things together, and one of the live experiences I talked about was music, playing music together. He said it releases chemicals.
I'm sure it does.
In the human body that make you feel better while you're doing something together.
I'm sure it does.
And
well, is what they say about choirs, isn't it?
I suppose, you know, that
singing, I mean, there's been a huge uptake of people singing, joining kind of online choirs. And even though you're on your own in your house, probably with your other half hearing this disembodied voice singing an ABBA chorus, you are part of this gang. And it apparently makes people feel fantastically high, you know, and fired up.
This is it. It's kind of non-addictive. Well, you might say it is addictive.
Probably addictive.
It's kind of, it's completely harmlessly addictive. But is that what you found in bands, Alex?
Yeah, definitely. There's something really irreplaceable about the feeling you get when you're playing with people you really like.
Yeah.
It's a really wonderful kind of feeling. It feels very reciprocal. It feels like
You're going to say it feels like sex, then. You nearly did that.
I haven't had sex, so I wouldn't know. But
it's overrated.
it feels like something that actually transcends what you're playing, if that makes sense. It's a bonding device. I don't think it's any coincidence that a lot of people who form bands are kind of a little bit disembodied from you know, kind of friendship groups. So they're a little bit outcasty, you know. So you sort of craving some kind, that kind of connection, and it's a really powerful way of receiving that connection, I suppose. As I think we said before, it's not really about the music; it's about what's between the notes.
Yeah. It's an intuition, don't you think?
Absolutely.
It's the kind of musical equivalent of finishing each other's sentences, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how many people, it's interesting how many people we've done, we've interviewed on our birthday special podcast with people who are subscribers. How many of them have been in bands and want to talk about the bands? Yeah. They've nearly all been in bands. And they've all had the same experience. And often those bands probably didn't even rehearse, but they existed for a while in a school playground and everybody had a role, everyone had an identity, the group had a name. Mm. Those things are incredibly important, I think.
Yeah.
Go on.
What about also the business of how that feeling spreads to people who aren't in the band, who are watching and listening to the band?
Well, I think part of the appeal of bands, for fans of music, is this notion of the gang, this secondary family that they want to be a part of. The Beatles are a prime example of that.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, we all love the Beatles music, but why do we really love the Beatles? We really love the Beatles because we want to be in that gang. We want to be, you know, part of the John, Paul, George and Ringo clique, really, deep in our souls, I think, because it caters to something really deep inside us.
Have you ever heard, at a slight Beatles tangent, have you ever heard the outtake from the recording of Think for Yourself, which is a George Harrison song that was on Rubber Soul? It's 19 minutes long. Maybe we should post it with this. It's fantastic. And it's the four of them doing the backing vocals for this song. And all they're trying to do is just make each other laugh. For 19 minutes, just wrong-footing each other, standing each other up, talking about... At one point, they all start doing the Woody Woodpecker theme tune. There's a bit where one of them wheels in, they start making up imaginary lyrics for a kind of Elvis Presley song. And one of them, I think it's Ringo, comes in with the lyric, "Lukewarm baby got a custard face." And you just think, I would give anything to be in this game. Because there they are, they're thinking, four people just thinking like one person. You know what I mean? It's that incredible intuition. And you just think, and that, I think, as getting back to your point, Dave, I think as an audience member, I think some of that must spill over when you see those groups up on stage. You just feel, I feel part of this.
Don't you think also, it might seem really kind of obvious to say it, but it's no longer just the four individuals, is it? It's the four individuals have become something else.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the kind of growth thing that happens.
Something far bigger than some of that.
Because one of the points he makes, is Robin Blackburn, is that if you perform anything, if you go for a run with a friend, you run more, you run better. You just, the two of you, without meaning to do it, just push each other a little bit like that.
I can corroborate that because I did a half marathon a couple of years ago with a pal of mine, and we made a pledge to stick together for the whole thing, and we did. And whenever one of us was lagging, we'd be trying to catch up with the other one, who'd be keeping pace, and we both got a really, really good time off the back of it.
But isn't a lot of that to do with the fact that if you're on your own, what you're preoccupied with is the race itself. It's how you feel physically. Are you tired? Can you cope? If there's somebody with you, you're thinking about, often even if you're not talking, you're thinking about something else. Or just your thoughts are directed in a different way. I don't know.
But I always like that thing. I was at Chris Charlesworth, I think, many, many years ago, wrote about The Who, that at their best, they seem to grow a fifth member.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really good, really good point, you know, that these things just absolutely take
completely
off.
Completely. It's like football teams.
Something different. Yeah.
Yeah, you watch a football team, sometimes think they must have 12 people or 13 people on the pitch. How are they doing this? It's magic. You know?
Well, I suppose it is this idea of this super entity being formed by the coagulation of all these. The Who are a really good example because obviously they complemented each other so well in so many different areas, musically and personally. And they're all weaker than the sum of their parts individually. Yeah. But when they came together.
So without being too kind of dewy-eyed about this, there is something about a group, a kind of traditional four-piece group along the lines of the Beatles and loads of others, that has magic at its heart.
Absolutely.
That a duo can never have.
No.
No.
Duo is not a gang.
I was watching
a documentary on BBC Four about Christine McVie, Christine Perfect, the other night, and I thought that really struck me. I know we've talked about it before, but there they are, Fleetwood Mac, making an album when Mick Fleetwood's just split up with his wife, and the other two four members of the group have split up with each other, And all five of them are going through these marriage breakups, and all five of them are having an unbelievably difficult time. And they still persevere. Obviously, they can see there's a commercial jackpot in it, but they still persevere. And still, under all what would be abnormal circumstances in any other world, put up with this, you know. And then she leaves the group for 15 years and comes back, and those four people are still there. What other line of business would that happen in? That's the strength of that bond. And if people are going to see Fleetwood Mac, so much of it must be about the bond between them, what they've been through. Don't you think?
Yeah, it's a family that lasts longer than most families.
It is.
Context is everything, though, isn't it? I mean, you know, I often wonder whether the songs that I really love would have the same weight if there wasn't some kind of story of discontent behind them, between the members, you know. How much that influences our view of the music and our view of the band, you know. Does the music rely on the context to succeed? Or,
well, I suppose, well, you know, when you get a group like Fleetwood Mac, what people are going to see is also to witness an unfolding story, aren't they?
Yeah.
Which is still
living
going
soap
on.
Opera.
It's a tale.
It
just
is.
Just go way back in time.
Yeah.
And God knows how long in the future, you know. It's a slightly different thing. But I was just, I was really struck by this conversation with Robbo Blackburn and applying it to bands and just the kind of, the idea that that you build up your friendship groups by personal contact, by, you know, facial expression, by eye contact, by touch, by those kind of things. And it's done very, very gradually over a long, long period of time. You know, you don't achieve any of those relationships overnight. They take a long time to build up.
Yeah.
And you know, bands have those things. So I thought it was interesting.
It is.
Yeah, addition to the conversation.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So Paul Simon's the latest one to sell his song catalogue to Sony, I think. And we can only speculate as to how much money he got. Who knows? But I just pulled out this CD here of a Paul Simon anthology just to run down and remind ourselves of which songs we're talking about here, okay?
What a staggering collection.
This is, oh my Lord. Here we go. Sound of Silence, Cecilia, El Condor Pasa, The Boxer, Mrs. Robinson, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard, Peace Like a River, Mother and Child Reunion, American Tune, Loving Like a Rock, Kodachrome, Gone at Last, Still Crazy After All These Years, Something So Right, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, Slip Sliding Away, Late in the Evening, Hearts and Bones, The Boy in the Bubble, Graceland, Under African Skies, Diamonds on the Soles of His Shoes, You Can Call Me Al, Homeless, The Obvious Child, Further to Fly, She Moves On, Born at the Right Time. And that's not even all of them. Because he had...
Did you have Bridge Over Troubled Water?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
But he didn't have Homeward Bound here. No. And doesn't have Scarborough Fair on there either.
It's got to be worth a couple of bob, isn't it?
You would have thought so.
I would have thought the value of that was enormous. Just, I can't help but feel it's got value in film soundtrack. They're universal, don't you think? Sound of Silence, Bridge Over Troubled Water, they're part of your emotional fabric in a very uncomplicated way. Don't you think? The appeal of those things is absolutely gigantic.
I suppose so. It's very difficult to know. I think what's driving this market at the moment is there's a lot of money looking for a place to invest, and you may as well invest in song catalogues as anything else, because you don't know what's going to prove to be popular in future. But if you've spread it far enough, some songs will be, won't they?
Yeah.
You know, but you've got no way of predicting what they are, really, you know. And I suppose people would rather invest in song catalogues than motor manufacturer or whatever, because
they're like also people are selling them because they're unsure as to whether or not they'll be making that amount of money in 10 years' time or whatever.
Well, in 10 years' time, they won't be here, will they? I mean,
yeah, true. But I can't help but feel if you sold a song catalogue, you'd really miss it. You'd really miss that involvement. I talked to a mate of mine the other day who's an author and has been writing books for 50 years. And she looks back at her credits, her publishing statements when they come through, with fascination to see which of her books are still selling.
Right.
And I think you'd become very interested in that. You know, you'd miss that whole thing of seeing how your various songs that you wrote back in the day were performing. Don't you think
maybe.
Then again, you've had a massive, great wedge of cash.
Absolutely.
Very attractive. You know?
Very large wedge of cash.
Yeah.
So we're looking at that clip of Paul Simon on the Dick Cavett show in the early 70s, explaining to Dick Cavett how he wrote Bridge Over Troubled Water. Which he's quite open about the fact that, oh, I got the basic tune. Was it from a Bach chorale?
It's a Bach chorale. The first tune, it's da 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 da. That's from Bach chorale. He nicks the entire thing, doesn't he? And then I think he finds a gospel song and takes the entire sequence of gospel chords and plays them all. And then, as if he hasn't done enough, steals the lyric, doesn't he, from a scat singer. He's watching a scat singer, and this guy talks about being I'll be your bridge over deep water. And he just says, I'll have that. So what he's actually saying is that every single component of that song he kind of stole. But you can't help but think that the creativity is in just having the invention and the imagination to see that those things would work together. It's not inventing them in the first place, don't you think?
I think that's absolutely compiling
those components, you know.
Because I could sit there with a guitar, and I know four chords on a guitar. You guys know a lot more. I could sit there with
you could play hundreds of songs.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I would never be able to play any of them because I don't have the talent. You know what I mean? Because I wouldn't recognize the patterns. I wouldn't know how to move from what I've got to what's next. Whereas if you put me to do something similar with words, I can kind of do it.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that's, people talk a lot about creativity. Personally, I think there's a lot of hoo-ha talked about creativity. But I think one of the key issues is can you, as a listener or a reader or a viewer of a painting, go from your experience of looking at it, listening to it, reading it, to kind of working out how it was done and then going back behind it and working it from the other side?
Yeah.
That seems to me the core creative act in the, you know, at work in something like Paul Simon's writing Bridge Over Troubled Water. It's knowing all those elements and then being able to hear beyond them.
Exactly.
And to make that leap into making it something that sounds utterly original.
Wasn't that what the Beatles essentially were doing in Hamburg? They were playing all the hit songs of the day and effectively getting inside them, reverse engineering them to be able to make...
Oh, I think there's no doubt. I mean, not just in Hamburg, I think... I mean, they went to the record shop and heard every new record and the B-side, and would work out how to play them. Now that much work under the bonnet has to teach you a lot about how you can take your own stuff forward.
And they would write in very specific where John Lennon sat down and said, "I will now write a song like Arthur Alexander," and wrote "All I've Got to Do" and "This Boy." And yes, it is. Whether or not he nicked bits of melody from Arthur Alexander or chord sequences, whatever, I don't know, but he wanted to do it as a pastiche of Arthur Alexander. So that's how he did it.
Creativity is the ability to reverse engineer, isn't it? Because, you know, you get so many players who are readers who absolutely flip out when they're asked to jam because the wiring is completely different.
Yeah.
But if you actively seek out a piece of art you like and deconstruct it yourself and figure out how it works, you're more predisposed, I think, to being able to put it back together in your own way.
Yeah.
But you've got to have the technical skills. I think this is, I have this argument with my wife all the time as a teacher. And, you know, teachers have to teach creative writing. I say, I've not a clue what it means. What does that mean, creative writing? If somebody asked me to sit down and say, be imaginative, go wild, I'd be completely lost. Whereas if somebody said, all right, write a story
about this.
About that tree down there, or what happened to you last Tuesday. You can do that.
Because
it's very specific, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas the idea that, that creativity comes with not being encumbered with technique is nonsense.
No, it's not.
You've got to have the technique, haven't you?
Completely.
to be able to move on. Which is where Paul Simon is a master of technique, isn't it?
Well, songwriters, it's also to do with the sheer quantity of songs that they know, that when you've got to a point in the song and they're not sure where to go, you're playing that chord, you must either consciously or unconsciously think of millions of options that you already know, because the Small Faces did this and the Beach Boys did this. And, you know, all those, so you can see why it must be so easy to produce songs that sound extraordinarily like other ones, whether consciously or unconsciously.
I'd suggest, though, that creativity isn't reliant on technique, but is reliant on imagination. And, Johnny Ramone, for example, couldn't play a minor chord, didn't know what one was. But I mean, how many albums did they put out? I think you're only limited by the limits of your ability to imagine what you can do with what you've got, rather than.
But that was just that's a statement by him. That's a position he'd taken up.
I don't think technique really governs your ability to create. You know, as long as you understand that you can do something with what you've got. You can, essentially. I know that sounds a bit airy-fairy, but I'm not sure that you need to necessarily be able to do something really well to be able to do something meaningful within your limitations.
Yeah, I don't know, really. It's I think a lot of it is just being able to do small things. If you can do small things, you can build them up slowly into bigger things. But the idea of, I always think nothing intimidates people more than being told, let your imagination run wild. Because everybody thinks, well, have I got one? Yeah. Whereas that's just too big a thing. Whereas, you know, design a little pop song that's 3 minutes long or write a short chapter in a book that leads to another chapter, you can kind of do that. It's small things. And I often think people, and it's a bit of a generalization, you know, I often think people who don't understand creativity always think it's about the big thing. I don't think it ever is about the big thing. I think it's about the little thing.
No, it's about technique, I think, a lot of the time.
I think it is.
Yeah,
it really is. And being able to move forward. Anyway, it's really interesting to see that Dick Cavett clip of Paul.
And I love the fact he's so honest about it as well. Because most people would say, I just kind of, it all came to me. But he goes, no, this was all stolen and assembled in this way.
Yeah.
And that's what those legal cases have to work out all the time. Did George Harrison kind of sit down and listen to He's So Fine? I think I'm going to write a song based on those chords. Or was that something he just heard a while back and just sort of, I don't know, did in his unconscious?
Anyway, while Paul Simon's in the news, bloke on the NBC News site got enormous traffic yesterday by writing quite a short piece about, a bit of a bitchy piece about Paul Simon, really. But basically the thrust of what he said was, Paul Simon will not be remembered in the future, certainly not compared to the Beatles and Bob Dylan.
But by the future, he meant 200 years, didn't he? He said specifically 200 years. But, I mean, that it's still chilling, didn't you think?
I thought it was a bit mean to Paul Simon.
Very mean.
But I think the bigger point is, who knows what will be remembered, you know, in 50 100, 150 years' time. Because, you know, how much of what we're, you know, we've no way of knowing what we will be remembered, because we've got nothing to compare it with. Because, you know, there's no history of recorded sound before 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Is there? You know what I mean? So, you know, the music of the 19th century and the 18th century is remembered because it was written down. You know, we talk about formal classical music, really, but anything else that people were listening to, we've no real way of knowing whether it's.
And also, a lot of it's. I think a lot of the appeal of music 200 years ago is that there are no lyrics a lot of the time. It's mostly instrumental music that people listen to, which doesn't tie it to a specific time. Yeah. You don't listen to Mendelssohn's E minor violin concerto and think, I am being transported back to 1840. Do you?
The good old days.
That's right. We were happy then. Yeah, no Brexit. Oh, it's lovely. Really good. No, I think that's a difference. And that's an interesting thing as to whether or not in the future you will associate Joni Mitchell or Leonard Cohen or whatever with a particular period in time, or will it be timeless? I like to think that Paul Simon songs are already timeless. He makes the point actually in that article that there are people already fading out of view, and he mentions Neil Young. I thought, that's true, actually. I felt that was true. Neil Young, partly because he's not in the frame and he's not active, he's not in any way front of mind, seems to be very slightly receding from my awareness.
I thought that was an odd example, really, because I thought Neil Young, you know, Neil Young's quite hot stuff still nowadays. Stephen Stills is not.
No, that's true.
You know, Graham Nash is not. Neil Young still is, oddly, you know, because it's kind of classic rock and it's chic and all those kind of things. But I think it's interesting to reflect. If you look at the pop, even at the pop music of the 20th century, you know, and the pop music of the recording era.
Yeah, how many people we've already forgotten?
How many people we have already forgotten? I mean, you know, Bing Crosby.
Yeah.
Bing Crosby, as big as the Beatles.
Yeah.
In an era before the Beatles. What does anybody know of Bing Crosby nowadays? White Christmas.
Yeah.
It doesn't go any further than that. Great artists, did loads of fantastic things. Loads of really interesting things, loads of really ahead of the time things. Everybody's forgotten about it completely because he's kind of not fashionable. Whereas somebody slightly later, Frank Sinatra, still quite hot.
Yeah, he is.
Partly because he's chic somehow. He's kind of eternally cool, isn't he? You know,
there are certain groups I can imagine. Queen's a good example. Elton John, Led Zeppelin, brilliant commercial practitioners of a particular type of music. I can imagine that receding slightly. I can imagine Charlie Parker, Miles Davis and Duke Ellington, for the reason I was talking about earlier, that it's mostly instrumental, lasting a bit longer. But I mean, what would be heartbreaking to me is the idea that the main architects of popular music would disappear from anybody's kind of awareness. Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, you know, Buddy Holly, the Stones, Little Richard, Everly Brothers, Chuck Berry, Beach Boys, James Brown. I don't know. There's those kind of people. You can't imagine that they would ever disappear. But
except I've written down a list here of people slightly earlier who I think have disappeared.
Yeah.
Caruso.
Yeah.
First great recording star, Caruso.
Yeah.
Benny Goodman. Benny Goodman, absolutely enormous in
he
the
was
40s.
Huge.
Johnny Ray.
Yeah,
enormous,
he was.
Completely forgotten. Somebody we were talking about only yesterday with a birthday patron, Harry Belafonte.
Yeah.
You might laugh now.
No, he was massive.
Three The Beatles, Harry Belafonte.
He was massive.
Jim Reeves.
Yeah.
Jim Reeves, absolutely huge. Nobody talks about Jim Reeves. Al Jolson.
Yeah.
Rudy Valli. Maurice Chevalier. All these people completely forgotten. Now, who's to say they might not reemerge in some shape or form? Something gets taken up by a TV ad or a movie soundtrack or God knows what. But, you know, it's not a case that you can guarantee that in 40 years' time, people will be talking about the Beatles. I don't know if they will. It'll depend what happens with music.
It'll depend if you listen to music in the same way. I mean, I don't know. Will we still be at home wanting some kind of background music? Will we be listening to music when we travel? Will it all come from advertising or from electronic devices? We've got absolutely no idea.
Yeah, no idea. So the idea that, that we've worked out the canon as it is right now and only these bits of it will be remembered, it doesn't work like that. The future may throw away our canon altogether.
Yeah.
Replace it with a totally different one, you know.
Yeah.
Who's to say? I don't know, Alex. Do you?
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So, Alex, you pointed out to me the other day that you'd spent the entire period during lockdown wearing, I wouldn't say the same jeans and T-shirt that you always wear, but basically wearing the rock and roll uniform of a black T-shirt, black jeans, black shoes, black accessories, and so forth, while relying on making up any thermal shortfall by cranking up the electric heating behind you, at enormous cost to the planet, but you're not bothered about that at all because you are so attached. Now, what I wanted to talk about you're so attached to this basic uniform that you have worn since leaving school, pretty much. And it struck, I've been thinking about this ever since. And it struck me that this is the uniform of undernourished young blokes with guitars, isn't it? Yeah. Basically how it works.
It says, I'm in a band, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. Oh, what are the, what are, tell us the basic rules about the uniform. What are the constituent parts, you know, where can you buy them, you know, what kind of,
thou
what
shalt
goes into your
black
personal style? Go on.
Thou shalt always buy your skinny threads from Top Man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, thou shalt wear Chuck Taylors or Cuban heels where possible.
What's Chuck Taylors? Come on, I want to know.
Converse, basketball sneakers.
Okay.
Colourful socks are allowed. So, for example, I've
let's
got
see them. Okay, so that's their only their only dash of self-expression, really.
Yeah, I've various pairs of unicorn socks as well. I'm feeling particularly fruity, but you're allowed colour on the sock, but elsewhere isn't really acceptable.
Okay.
You have to, you know, make it clear that you're wearing black for the working man. You know,
I know. What about jackets and kind of outerwear and so forth?
Tiny leather jackets, the smaller the better, preferably. The tighter fitting.
So I'm going to say they've got to be really uncomfortable and impractical, haven't they?
No, they're not. They're really. It's like wearing a hug. It's like you're putting a hug onto yourself. It's actually, quite comfortable. Yeah, I've got this. I've got two actually. I've got two leather, well, faux leather jackets. And I think they're size 6 or 8, like really, really tiny.
Have you got them there? Have you got them within reach?
Over here, actually.
Go on, I want to see this. Is the jacket... The jacket is so small, the only thing you can do is play the guitar in. You couldn't chop a tree down or anything like that.
This is a Zara number.
All right.
If I nip it on, I'm going to move my chair. Ugh. Okay. So, as you can see...
Is that a girl's jacket, Magic, or is that a bloke's jacket?
A girl's jacket.
Oh, it is a girl's jacket.
So that's my waist there. This jacket sits very, very definitely a couple of inches above the waist.
That's amazing.
It's kind of nice, though, when it's warm.
Yeah. That's so good.
Yeah.
So where did the concept of... Because I've got a theory. Well, it's not my theory. It's somebody else's, actually. Where did the concept of black... meaning outlaw, rebel, renegade, gun for hire? Because that's partly the reason you're wearing it, isn't it? It's the rock and roll thing. Where did that concept come from?
You know me, guys.
Yeah. Because I'll tell you, when I interviewed Keith Richards for Word, he had a really good point. He was talking about it being the anti-Beatles. That was their image, you know. And he said the Beatles had the white hat. They're already wearing the white hat, meaning the cowboy hat. He said the only hat left was the black hat, and that's the hat we wore. And we talked about that. His theory was that it was the Western movie that invented the idea of black and white.
Oh, that's a good
point. I thought, that is brilliant, because I couldn't think of anything before that.
That's a really good point.
It's really good, isn't it? Because villains wear black. Because the good guy, up until that point, the good guy always wore, well, in those films, always wears white. And the Lee Van
Cleef hat is black.
That's the important thing. I'd
have to go back and look at High Noon. By God, because the gunmen are coming into town, aren't they, to kill him? And they must be wearing all black.
I had not thought
of that.
And his theory was that that's where that concept came from. So if you look, say, Pat Boone is a white concept. Pat Boone nearly always wore white, actually, and he's wholesome and he's, you know, he's acceptable and he's family friendly.
Yeah.
But, you know, Johnny Cash or Roy Orbison, really good. Roy Orbison, really good example, actually, because he wasn't kind of rebellious in the old fashioned way. He was, I think the word would be damaged. When I was a kid, I used to look at Roy Orbison and think, something's happened to this guy.
My God.
Two of his kids die in a house fire.
That was terrible, awful.
But anyway, so the bad things. So I thought that was a really good point. So that was Keith Richards' theory, that the cowboy movie invented that black and white theory.
And the cowboy movie invented so many things about rock and roll. That's a really interesting
way of looking. The idea of the lone gunslinger, didn't it?
But then it's only... I know what you mean, and there's a long kind of history of black in popular music. But it's only probably in the last 30 years, maybe a bit more, that you've been able to get on the tube in London and know that during your journey, decent journey, half an hour, one person, at least one person, will get on that tube who will be dressed just like Alex is.
Yep.
And they'll either be carrying a guitar or you'll be pretty certain that they're on their way to pick up a guitar somewhere. Absolutely. You know, there are thousands of these people, tens of thousands of these people in
London.
And
they'll give you that slightly pitying, slightly condescending look as if to say, you tragic wage slave. You know, tied to your little suburban life and your pathetic job. Yeah. Don't be late for work, mate, because I'm a maverick. I can't be tamed. I can't be rubber stamped.
Yes, I'm on my way to drink a half pint of cider somewhere. While play smoke
like
on the water. You must do this, Alex, you know, in normal times when you get on the tube or the train or whatever, you must come across kindred spirits and you must exchange knowing glances.
What, you mean like the white van club? Just give each other little nods. Subtle little what?
Respect.
No, yeah. No, kindred actually. Because, I mean, there's loads of them now. They're everywhere. And
they're dead common now, are they?
Yeah.
And, you know, when I started doing it, there were very few of us people about. I think that was the appeal, you know. It was like a little sort of, it's like a branch off from society, you know. It was our little club, you know, our kind, our little tribe. But I think, you know, Top Man kind of monopolised... or capitalised on that market, and it's
did they?
Yeah, indie chic. I don't think it's particularly reserved for the tribe anymore. That's the thing. And interestingly, musicians of the latest generation who are coming through, they tend to be very, very colourful. And I think that's because that, you know, when I was forming bands in school, at least, there was an element of anti-establishment in it. You know, trying to get away from having a normal life and. You know, being sort of separate to the rest of society. I don't think kids these days have the same desire, really. I don't think there's any sort of countercultural motivation for musicians making music in 2020, 2021. And thus there is very little need for black.
Oh, well. Maybe. Well, you might be right for reasons similar to those that Gary Kemp, indicated, as we were mentioning earlier. That it's not about going anywhere anymore, is it? It's not about making an entrance any longer, yeah. You know, and having people, yeah. You know, because I suppose that's the way you used to communicate with people, wasn't it? You turned up in a pub in Cirencester, and as soon as you went in the door, it was clear who you were, wasn't it? You know, and what you like.
This tribe. Yeah,
I belong to that group, whereas you don't do it anymore. Tell you the other thing that struck me about it is it's not just music, it's a certain kind of music it indicates, isn't it? It indicates guitars, amplifiers, and drums, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
It doesn't indicate keyboards, it doesn't indicate, I don't know, the Chemical Brothers or the Pet Shop Boys or any of their many...
No, it's old-fashioned rock and roll, isn't it? Yeah, rock bands.
It is.
It's about attitude, isn't it? About what you represent.
It's a subculture thing, and I would argue that indie is probably the last British musical subculture.
Oh.
And that, you know, everybody's a little bit of everything these days, which is great, which is absolutely fantastic. But, you know, in days gone by, you were one thing or you were another. And the indie thing kind of went on until the mid to late noughties, I suppose. And I can't think of anything in particular, any particular single movement that happened after that. So what we're seeing is the last dregs of...
You are the Teddy Boys of our time. That's the Teddy Boys still were around in the '60s, weren't they? And even in the early '70s.
Yeah.
And they just they just kind of faded away.
I'm basically that the embodiment of that Japanese soldier that was found 60 years
ago. There you go.
Still fighting the fight.
Yeah, living in the jungle. Didn't realise the war was over. That's it.
It's over, Alex. It's over. Indeed.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant.
It's over. You're not going to get your letter from John Peel.
Pigeon Detectives aren't in the chart.
Talking of letters, we must mention. Have we got time to mention?
Have we got time? It's a podcast, Mark.
It's a podcast, precisely. There was this brilliant letter that's been—it's been all over the internet and all over Twitter. You know, it's the rejection letter, supposedly from Polydor Records, to Brian Ferry, isn't it? Written on the 30th of June, 1971, and on the Polydor letter-headed paper from their office in Stratford Place. Basically saying, we're not offering you a contract, and your music is too experimental and freeform to have a hope of attracting enough public attention to enter the musical charts. The main instruments seem competently played, but the songwriting sometimes lacks the focus with which a more conventional structure would provide. The electronic sounds are interesting, but fall short of the musicality of Walter Carlos, for example. It's a lovely bit at the end. It says, the lyrics sound promising in places, but the lead vocals, in the words of one respected member of my department, tend to sound, and to put one in mind, of Frankie Vaughan locked in a haunted house. It's absolutely fantastic. I mean, it is a fake, isn't it? I think we have to agree. It's a fake.
Well, the idea, first of all, that any record company has ever written so long a rejection letter for anything.
They would simply say thanks, but no thanks.
Thanks very much. It's not hard kind of thing.
It makes it worse apologising. Yeah.
And also the idea is a very modern idea that the qualities of Roxy music were so plain to everybody that only a company so out of touch as Polydor could possibly have turned them down, which is nonsense. You know what I mean? You know, Roxy Music were made it by luck. You know, they had the right kind of management, the right kind of financing. Island Records weren't even sure about signing them, you know.
No, absolutely. They were not a commercial prospect at all.
Absolutely not at all.
It required a huge leap of faith and imagination. Yeah, actually, boringly, I think there are another two giveaways on this thing. I don't think they were called Roxy Music.
No, they weren't.
On June the 30th, 1971, I think they were called Roxy.
Well, they weren't called Roxy. There was a Canadian group called Roxy, and they had to change their name.
Yeah, but not till November of that year. And also, at the end, the guy says, to reward your interest in our company, I enclose a complimentary cassette of James Last's latest hit album for Polydor, Poker Party. I mean, A, that would never have happened. And B, actually, Poker Party, boringly, that didn't come out till the end of the year, too. Oh, so right. It didn't exist. I do think these things are fantastic, you know, because the amount of work and effort that went into making that look plausible. There was one about the Beatles. Do you remember? That's what started, I think. There was one two or three years ago.
Oh, is it?
Letter. Yeah, it's the Royal Albert Hall writing to Brian Epstein. Again, you know, letter-headed paper, completely convincing, saying that they're upset about his new album, the band's new album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, because it has a song on it which alludes to there being holes, 4,000 holes in the Albert Hall. They're concerned about this, you know, the reputation of the place as being safe to enter and go to a concert in. And there's a fake letter from John Lennon writing back to him. And it's really convincing and really funny, but it's not true.
It's not true.
No.
But it set me to thinking about people always think it's terrible when record companies pass on things or reject things or don't renew people's contracts or whatever. Yeah. I take the opposite view. I think it's almost always a good thing because what I've found in life is people don't like to say yes, but they don't like to say no either. You know, what they like to do is just keep the options open as long as they possibly can. Whereas if Polydor had been faced by the real Roxy Music, and if Polydor had decided that they didn't want Roxy Music, that's completely fine. Because it would have been in Roxy Music's interest to go somewhere else where people wanted them. And it would have been in Polydor's interest to carry on doing what Polydor did.
Yeah, it would have been the wrong people to sign them in the first place.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it a lot of time in life will be saved by people being prepared to say no earlier on. And I think people are really unwilling to say it because it seems so anti-creative and all this kind of thing. You know, I was very struck by, was it is it Philip Roth? I can't remember. I think it's Philip Roth, the novelist. He used to go for a cup of coffee in the same place in New York every morning, and the waiter, one of the waiters there, was a guy writing a novel, young guy writing a novel, and he finally got up his courage, and said, "Mr. Roth, here's my novel. I wonder if you mind reading it, his manuscript, or whatever." And Roth said, sit down. And pretty much said, don't do this. Don't do this. Don't embark on this life. You will not make yourself any happier. It won't work. You know, stop it and go and do something else. Which, you know, some people interpret as a terribly callous way
that
to go on.
That seems incredibly harsh. Having never read a word of it, it could have been a work of genius, but, you know.
Okay, what's the chances?
Of course, 99% of the time, precisely.
Okay, and here's the point. If it was a work of genius, what Philip Roth had to say about it wouldn't matter one way or another, because it would find some other way of getting there, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And so...
But the truth is that somebody sat down and written a novel. It will not be... Very rarely does anybody's first novel in that form ever get published. What they do is reject that, or someone rejects it, and they write another and another and another, and they're fourth. By the time they've written their fourth, they've understood what a novel involves.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe that's true.
You've got to admit, the same again. Sorry, it's a slight Beatles tangent again, actually, but the Beatles and with Derek Rowe, you know. Dick Rowe, well, that's Derek Rowe. Being turned down in whatever it was, 1962. I mean, you know, why not? They were playing Three Cool Cats, Besame Mucho. You know,
also,
they were playing...
also Decca would have screwed them up completely, the wrong place.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I think rejection is always good for the soul.
Lady Gaga was signed to Def Jam, I think, for a year, and they did absolutely nothing with her at all. And it's the idea that they did nothing with her and then just let her go was part of the reason she had such a kind of such motivation to go out and make it, you know.
Yeah.
It's good for you. It's like relationships. Everybody in life should be dumped. At some stage of their life, they should be dumped. Don't you think? People who've never been dumped are not fully formed characters.
I've never met anybody who's never been dumped.
No, I know, very rarely. I know two or three. I don't think it's good for them.
No.
I think you need to be prepared for things going wrong in life.
Yeah. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think with creators, there's a very real tendency to get trapped in this fantasy version of who you think you are. And being rejected, I think, brings you back to what's actually required to make what you're doing any good. So, yes, I would wholeheartedly agree.
I think Laurence Olivier said to people who said, should I be an actor? I think he used to say, well, if you want to be an actor, you will be an actor. And if you're not an actor, you didn't want it enough. Because most actors don't do any acting. They're out of work actors, but they're so devoted to it, that's what they're prepared to do. So
didn't you feel that when we were in magazines, you and I were asked all the time by people wanting to write for magazines, you know?
Oh,
and I kind of like to write reviews, you know. And you'd say, well, what have you written so far? I'd say, well, no, I haven't written it, actually. I used to say, well, you know, the people who tend to be writers, successful writers, the ones who write.
They write.
They start about the age of eight writing little short stories, you know, and then by the age of 10, they're compiling a diary or whatever, and they're writing all the time. They're compelled to write, and they're compelled also to read. You'd say, well, which authors do you like? And they go, well, I don't read that much. I'm trying to keep my style original. I don't want to be intuitive.
Yes.
You think, what? You know, the whole point is read as much as is humanly possible and absorb the good stuff and reject what you don't like. But just for God's sake, it's like songwriters saying, I think I might do a bit of songwriting. Well, you'd know if you were a songwriter.
Yeah.
We were in that really interesting conversation with Gary Kemp the other day. Yeah, it's Gary Kemp writing songs, wasn't he, when he was about 7 or 8? He got a Burt Whedon songbook.
Yeah.
It was really interesting, actually. And he learned all these chords, but he didn't like the songs that the chords were the chords to. So he wrote his own words. And then eventually, I think he told us that he wrote True was based on two things, wasn't it? One was I Dig a Pony.
Dig a Pony by the Beatles.
Because it starts, I. So that's a really good idea. You take the word I and you can sing it several times, you know.
Yeah.
And because True starts with whatever it is. Yeah. And he said he then took the chords to If I Had a Hammer. So he took a go, I had a hammer and I dig a pony, and somehow managed to synthesize true. Good work. That's very, very interesting.
I think If I Had a Hammer was also, if I'm remembering right, was in his Burt Weedon Playing a Day book.
It was. That's where he got it from. Fantastic.
Well, it's a really good Word of Your Essex, which we recorded with him last week, which will be out with you very soon. What else we got coming up, Alex? We've got on Thursday night...
A crowdcast.
Oh, yeah, we have.
Yeah, which if you're a patron...
Oh, about the fall.
Yes.
While we record.
Yeah.
And that's about the fall book, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is.
What else have we got? Really we good. Got it's coming up with...
Bob Stanley and Tessa Norton.
Yeah.
So, it's a book about the fall called Excavate.
So if you're keen on the fall, join us on Thursday evening if you're a Patreon supporter. And
we're talking to the two guys from the Nothing Is Real Beatles podcast tomorrow morning too.
Tomorrow, yeah. So that'll be with you later in the week. And then usual Friday night quiz back on Friday nights, 6 o'clock. And do join us for that. And if you're looking for a way to get involved further, go to patreon.com/wordinyour.
We have further details.
Do we have new patrons? Okay.
Welcome
aboard. Yeah.
Go on, pipe them in.
Okay. Hearty welcome to Chuck Lonson, who.
Talked to him only yesterday.
Yeah.
Lovely guy.
In Savannah, Georgia.
Indeed. Yeah. Michael Cole.
Welcome aboard.
Graham Crossley.
Graham. Hurrah. Hello, Graham.
Stuart Hanscombe,
also.
You're very welcome.
Richard Lyons, hello, Richard.
Have some peanuts, have a glass of ale, join the party.
Have you met the major?
Wallace Dobbin,
fine.
That's a good name.
Fine name, Wallace.
And Kevin Stark.
Also, superb. Kevin, nice to see you
Extremely welcome.
And join the fun.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.